Accession number 21063, Reel 2.
Squadron Leader Lee, Reel 2.
So by this time I'd used most of my ammunition, but had to take evasive action because the Stukas behind were all firing at me as well. And I had to pull away.
What was the Stuka doing that you shot down? Was it just making for home?
Well, he was making for home. He'd dropped his bomb, so his job was to get home as quickly as possible.
What kind of level was he at?
I suppose we were all about 100, 200 feet.
Any other incidents from this period?
Well, it was a bit repetitious. I mean, it was sometimes, some days we wouldn't make any contacts at all, and the other days we'd come on a formation and done what we've done before. We'd go in behind and shoot off all your ammunition as much as you can. Sometimes they went down, sometimes they didn't. But you see, after I got shot down myself on the 16th or the 18th of August, when the squadron was being directed onto a raid, and they were flying very tight formation, and this time I wasn't doing the rear cover, I was leading a section. And so the people who were doing the rear cover weren't really up to the job, and they got picked off by Hauptmann Schopfel, one by one, and then he flew into the central formation and shot me down. So the squadron flew on, the remaining seven of them, but meanwhile, four had been shot down by Schopfel without the squadron knowing. And because the two men who were doing the rear cover, the officer and Charlie, which should have been my job, were not up to it and and the squadron suffered accordingly, but without knowing until they got back to base.
Was that because they were inexperienced?
They were inexperienced, yes. We weren't supposed to be going on this raid at all. We were only supposed to be going back to Gravesend, back to our base. But when we were halfway home, they were diverted onto this, with this big raid coming in to go and attack it. But because we weren't going on a raid, I didn't do the rear cover myself. I appointed two other men to practice rear cover. And so I really blame myself for the whole fiasco.
What were your first sensations when you were shot down?
Well, I was hit in the leg, so I wondered what had happened to my leg, and then I was 17,000 feet when I was actually hit, and I lost forward, backwards and forwards control, and the prop stopped. So I rolled over my back this time intentionally and dropped out. But at 17,000 feet, I was in the middle of any air battle that was likely to be going on. So I decided to do a delay drop, which I did for 1 minute on a stopwatch, and dropped 10,000 feet there, 12,000 feet, free fall, to get out of the battle. And then pulled my chute at about 5,000 feet. And landed in a cornfield.
Did you have a reception party on this occasion?
I was captured by an old fellow who'd been at Gallipoli. He was wearing his service cap from 1914, and he had a Turkish rifle which he captured from the Turks himself. And he held me up at this rifle because it was such a glorious day, and as I say, we were only going back to base, so I wasn't even wearing a uniform tunic. I'd taken my tunic off and put it in the tail of the aircraft. So I was in shirt sleeves and in no way of recognising me as a British officer.
What did he say to you?
Well, he never said a word. He just pointed his gun until the London Irish arrived, and who immediately established who I was, and took me off.
Did you attempt to reason with him?
I really don't remember very clearly. I just remember a bump onto the ground, and then I sat up, and there was this man with a gun pointing at me.
But he told you he was a Gallipoli veteran.
Well, I learned this. I mean, I certainly learned this at that time. I don't think we ever got into conversation. I was carried off by the London Irish to the local golf club, where they gave me a couple of drinks to encourage me.
Was this in Kent?
This was just near Whitstable.
Any other Battle of Britain memories?
Well, no, because then I was, I went to Leeds Castle, where I was operated on to take this bullet out of my leg. And of course, I then had to have about 4 weeks before I could walk. And when I got back to the squadron, there were the real activity had died down. So foster patrols and the odd fleeting engagement, I had no more participation in the battle.
What had been your attitude towards the Germans during the Battle of Britain?
Just like them, we were delighted that they were there, because we'd been practicing shooting, and we'd been practicing air combat, and we at last could use it.
Was there any hatred?
Any
hatred?
No, I can't think of any hatred at all. No, I mean, we didn't know, like we do now, that horrible things the Germans did do. So there was no real to hatred. They were just the enemy. And with the background of 1418 war, as I was brought up there, they were just the Hun, to some extent, a figure of fun, the Hun. I mean, our phrase, beware of the Hun in the sun, was a thing from the 1418 war.
Had you thought that they might win?
I don't think we ever considered that, no. I mean, we just won one war. It was just a repetition or a round two of the same war.
Had you thought they might invade?
Well, definitely. I thought at one time it really looked as though they were going to invade. And we were certainly very, very conscious of the fact that we were underarmed and underprotected. When they first formed the Royal Air Force Regiment, which was to protect aerodromes against ground attack and against a parachute attack, I was at Kenley, and the regiment there were actually armed with pikes. They had no rifles, they were armed with pikes with which they were to repel the parachutists as they came down by poking them at the bottom with their pikes.
What was your opinion at that time of the aircraft types that the enemy fielded?
Well, we were quite happy with our Hurricanes, and of course the Spitfires were supposed to be. We were always conscious the Spitfires were 4,000 feet higher than we were, which is, you like always to be above the enemy if you can. But you see, it worked out quite well. The Spitfires did the top cover and kept the fighters away, whilst the Hurricanes waded into the middle of the body of these big attacks.
But what did you think of the 109 and the 110 and the Heinkel and so on?
Well, I mean, I personally only had one engagement with the 109, but several with the 110s. The 110s were quite easy. We could turn well inside their circle, and they were comparatively easy, although there was a rear gunner. But the 109s were, again, in level combat. If they were above you, it was a little bit dicey. But once you got on their level and you started turning, you could always get round behind them.
What was this occasion when you fought a 109?
that was in France there, in the just one of these, when we were on one of these patrols, some 109s jumped us and came back for a second pass. By the time that we were going flying towards them instead of them coming behind us, and when they came towards us, we turned, and I managed to turn inside one of them there, and I had a couple of shots at him, and nothing happened. And but I mean, I certainly, although he had the advantage to begin with, I survived an attack which I theoretically should not have survived, purely by the maneuverability of my own aircraft, I think.
Did you make a full recovery from your wounds?
Yeah, I've never been worried about it until about 3 months ago. I've started getting pains in my right ankle, which I am told could be contributory to the bullet wounds, could be contributory to that. But I've never had trouble for 60 years.
Going back to 1940, what happened once you had finished with your medical treatment?
Then I went back to the squadron. The squadron had moved back to Kenley by that time. And was doing a little bit of... I was on several engagements with them without any success. But although the squadron was still getting a reason... We didn't get as many aircraft at that time as we had in the earlier part of the war.
But what was the reason for that?
I think, again, they were... We had great difficulty getting up to them before being jumped by the fighters. We were they were flying higher than they had been, and I really don't know. Just it wasn't quite as easy as it had been to start with. When we found these patrol the formations of 12, 14 or 4 aircraft flying around on their own in France without cover, it was easy pickings, but later on it became more difficult.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, I mean, I was there again until then. I was posted to be a flight commander in a fighter training school in Carlisle, for Hurricanes, for pilots coming from the Empire training scheme and who'd been taught to fly to a certain standard and now had to be converted from their training aircraft onto Hurricanes. That's flight command of Sea Flight at Crosby-on-Eden.
How did that job suit you?
Well, that suited me great. Again, you had the Hurricane to fly, and you had the best Hurricane in the flight to fly it for yourself. And great satisfaction having a course of 25 embryo fighter pilots and turning them out at the end of 8 weeks as fighter pilots.
Were there any lessons which you had to inculcate which were difficult to get across?
No, because the failing, and still at this time of the war, was the Air Force's concentration on formation flying. And this formation flying, while it gets the unit from one place to another in one piece, and is good in attack on an enemy formation of you can go in bulk and really attack. You are not at liberty to use your eyesight and your initiative as you would be if you're flying in loose fighting pairs as the Germans were doing. And we were still teaching people to fly in formation, and formation was the essence of a good pilot. If you're a good formation flyer, you were thought to be a good pilot. But it was a great waste of time.
Did you make that view known?
Not then. Then all of us now, when we talk about this after the event, we're all fully agreed that this was a big mistake, and we would have had far more results earlier on in the war, and far more if we'd have got this idea across. But the Germans have been doing it since the Spanish Civil War, and somehow or other our air attaches never brought this to our attention, or never it was never part of, it was never suggested until quite late on in the war.
So why do you think the RAF were obsessed with formation flying?
It was tradition. Right from the 1418 war and right through between the wars, the mark of good pilots was good formation flying. And the first innovation was this idea of having the loose aircraft or pair of aircraft flying rear cover for the squadron as the squadron proceeded in formation. That was the very first step towards breaking up this obsession with the formation.
Any incidents that happened to you at Crosby?
I did have one incident which was very frightening. I was just doing an air test, just to take an aircraft and make sure it was serviceable for the student pilots, and doing a very rapid takeoff and turn round. I went round the aerodrome, came up to about 1,000 feet, shot open the hood in order to make my landing approach. As the hood shot back, a wave of petrol hit me in the face. The filler cap had come off the header tank of the petrol, which is right in front of the pilot in the Hurricane, and drenched me from head to foot in petrol. Petrol and air and that sort of thing is a most explosive mixture. Any kind of a spark, the thing would have blown up like a bomb. And my feet were, I was covered with petrol. My feet were skidding about on the rudder bar, but I managed to continue with my approach. And when I landed and taxied the moment I landed, I cut the engine off and left the aircraft rolling on the runway, and got out in a temper to go to the flight sergeant in charge of the flight and say that, you know, this tank was not fully screwed up. And, of course, that was probably one of the times I put somebody on a very serious charge, was he hadn't tightened the filler tank, header tank. But it was probably the most dangerous thing that ever happened to me, apart from actually being hit by aircraft fire. Will you excuse me a moment there?
Did the Germans ever try to shoot Crosby up, the training centre?
Oh, no, never. Never even saw, never even had, not even an air raid, a night raid, nothing up there.
What was the next thing that happened to you?
The next thing, I was given command of 100 Australian, Canadian, New Zealand sergeant pilots and officer pilots, who'd come from flying training, from operational training units as fighter pilots, and to take them to the Middle East. And we boarded the vessel in Liverpool, the SS Alcantara, and it set off in a convoy. The convoy was going to Madagascar. It set off across the Atlantic, and we were out in the very middle of the Atlantic when one of the German pocket battleships was supposed to be out there, and the Alcantara was officially an armed merchant cruiser. It meant it had one gun on the foredeck, and we were diverted to go and meet this cruiser, divert it away from the convoy itself. But fortunately, it was attacked by some British submarines and it went back itself, so that we turned back and rejoined the convoy and went on and crossed down to Takoradi in West Africa, where we all offloaded and they sat there in a transit camp waiting to fly individual Hurricanes across North Africa to Cairo. which was about a six-stage flight with long-range tanks from the West African coast to the Nile and down the Nile to Cairo. It was a very interesting experience for someone who'd never been out of, more than to the south of France.
What particularly interesting things happened?
Well, the first thing we did, we tried to do a long hop. We flew from Takoradi to, we flew to Lagos, but no, we seemed to be doing such good time. We decided to fly on to a place called Oshogbo, which was a little strip in the jungle 200 miles north of Lagos on our way up to Kano. And we landed there in amongst these huge palm trees, which I'd never done before, down, flying down in between trees, below the level of the trees, in order to land on this strip. And so we taxied in and stopped and got, and the officer in charge of the strip said, "What are you doing here?" So he said, "Well, we come to refuel before flying on to Kano." He said, "You won't refuel here, man, we've got no petrol." So you have to wait until we get so up from the coast. So it took, we were there probably 7 or 8 days whilst they brought petrol, cans of petrol up in lighters up the Niger River, and then brought them into this place and refueled. And then we sat on the runway waiting for the next convoy to fly across, and we took off and joined that and followed it up to Kano in northern Nigeria. There we flew on to Maiduguri, and then across the Lake Chad area to El Fasher, El Geneina, one aerodrome after another, out in the huge expanses of desert, and then on to the Nile, and then down the Nile to Cairo, where we delivered the aircraft, and then looked for orders at the headquarters of RAF in the desert, and I was then posted as flight commander with Billy Drake, who was commanding in 260 Squadron. Where they were flying war hawks, kitty hawks, which I'd never seen before. So I joined them, and we started doing Gazala. And within a week, we started retreat from Gazala. So we retreated all the way back to Gazala, right all the way back to El Alamein, chased by the Germans all the way, doing dive bombing and trying to on their advancing columns, and not seeing any aircraft, but mainly dive bombing and ground strafing. And then the Germans eventually ran out of steam when they got to El Alamein. And we then the line reformed then, and we sat there and started then the bombing began to build up of the Germans there, and we began to build up our campaign for the El Alamein campaign itself.
What did that involve?
That involved probably 10 flights a day escorting Mitchells and Boston, American-built aircraft there, to bomb the German lines just behind the Alamein line and their supply lines. And back and so about 20 Bostons at a time with a squadron of Kitty Hawks or War Hawks. We flew escort them to keep the German fighters away, which we saw very few of, and we carried a bomb as well. So when they bombed, we bombed. We just pulled a piece of string and the bomb fell off, together with all the bombs from the formation we were escorting, just to add to the pressure. And that went on for 3 or 4 weeks until the actual Alamein campaign itself.
What's the difference between a war hawk and a kitty hawk?
Well, the kitty hawk has an Allison engine, and the war hawk has a Rolls-Royce engine built on the license. Twice the aircraft, twice the aircraft.
You mean a lot superior?
A lot superior, yes. And more reliable. The Allison had electrical controls which were inclined to go wrong, and run engine speed would run away with you. The air screw would run away. But the Hurricane was, again, the Warhawk was like a Hurricane. It was, although it was a much more roomy aircraft and heavier guns, we had 50 caliber machine guns instead of 303.
How did you like flying these planes after the Hurricane?
Well, it was rather like flying in a greenhouse, a huge, spacious cockpit, very much more luxurious, but again, very much more fancy. There were, where a Hurricane probably had about 12 switches and levers you needed to operate it, the Warhawk had about 35, and you have to remember all these things, buttons to switch on and switch off, and far more complicated, but a very nice aircraft.
How did you like doing this kind of work, escorting and bombing?
Well, certainly dive bombing and strafing was far more dangerous than flying in the Battle of Britain. And I mean, you're diving on a gun position and they're shooting up at you, doesn't matter what kind, how good a pilot you are, if he's a good shot, he'll hit you. And you've got to keep going straight if you're going to hit the target. So it was, you were lucky to get away with that.
What kind of success do you think you had on these raids?
Well, I mean, I think I know I hit one or two targets, and I could with the bombs, and I could actually see when you were strafing a column or some tanks or something like that. You could actually see when your bullets were hitting the ground. Like in the desert, there's plenty of dust, and dirt, when your 50 calibers are hitting near the target, you know you're on the target. So, but without getting out of your aircraft and going to inspect it, you can't tell what damage you did do unless the thing burst into flames. So we did a lot of damage, and it certainly contributed to weakening the Germans. So when the El Alamein battle began,
did you get damaged or shot up on this work?
I got one Scot a bullet through the. But through the aircraft, it went through the battery at the back of the aircraft. But that was from the ground fire, just one bullet. But apart from that, no.
What happened next?
Well, I got dengue fever, and was sent to convalescent camp in Palestine, and I was there for probably a month. When I came back, the squadron moved on up the desert, and I was then given command of a flight of Hurricanes, which was stationed at Tehran in Persia.
Which squadron was this?
This was 123 Squadron. So I was told to go to Persia, so and with with three or four more pilots who were going to join the squadron as well. So we set off from Cairo, and we went across the Sinai Desert, and we eventually got to Damascus. In Damascus, we got on a bus called the Nairn Transport, which went across the desert towards Baghdad and Habaniya, which was an RAF station. Anyway, we went across the desert on this bus, and eventually got to a place called Rotbar, completely out in the middle of the blue, where I went for a short walk while we were waiting for the bus to refuel, and saw what I never would imagine I'd see in my life, saw oil actually seeping out of the ground. So it was in the middle of, apparently, where later on all the oil fields were. So we got to Habonera, and there we waited for a week while we were waiting for a ferry to get. Then we got on a ferry which went down the a paddle boat, which went down the Euphrates, down to a place called Khorram Shah, which was the railhead for the Persian railway. There we got on the rail.